Welcome back, Hemingway listeners, to the Hemingway List, Part 8, Chapter 15 of Anna Karenina. Only three to go. 16, 17, 18, 19. That's four to go, I meant to say. And then we start the American. Acoustic Eel says, I can't wait. The book just came in for me on hold at the library. Actually, all of them did. I didn't know what the poll results would be, but I wanted to make sure I had the book before we started, so I put all eight of them on hold. Nicely done, Acoustic Eels. Hey, we hope to see you in the discussions. Drop us a line sometime. My discussion prompt for chapter 15 was this brain offline again, BYO prompts. Sorry guys, my brain is offline. I don't know, it's just something about these last few chapters of this book that's just not inspiring any brain activity in my head. It's the kindest way I can put it. Charlotte said, I looked up Dostoevsky's thoughts on Anna Karenina, which he published in a newspaper column at the time, and is now available in A Writer's Diary, Volume 2, by Northwestern University Press. Dostoevsky was very unhappy about Tolstoy's treatment of the Slavonic question, or the Eastern question, whether Russia should come to the aid of the Serbians in Turkey. He says, people may understand how I was affected by the definition of such an author, defection of such an author, by his secession from the great Russian and general cause, and by the paradoxical untruth he tells about the people in the unfortunate eighth part of his novel. The fact that such an author can write this way is very sad. It's sad for the future. Dostoevsky was in favour of the volunteers and didn't like how Tolstoy portrayed them. He also thinks the characters who criticise the volunteers are standing in for Tolstoy's views, while the others simply give a bit of plausible deniability so Tolstoy can claim he represented all sides of the argument. Sounds pretty Dostoy to me, actually. Personally, I find all the discussion of the Slavonic question pretty boring, so it was interesting to see Dostoy's seize on that to discuss, while skipping over all the events leading up to Anna's suicide. He does say, when I began publishing my diary last year, I resolved to make no place in it for literary criticism, but feelings are not criticism, though I may express them about a work of literature. So he is not really discussing Anna Karenina as a book, but rather using it as a jumping-off point to discuss a topic he's interested in. Wow, that's a very roundabout way. One more factoid. Apparently, Part 8 was too politically controversial and had to be published separately again from Dostoy. That same morning, I had just seen for the first time the announcement in the newspaper of the separate publication of the eighth part of the final novel of Anna Karenina that had been rejected by the editor of the Russian Messenger, the journal in which the novel had been appearing since its beginning. Everyone also knew that this final eighth part had been rejected because of its disagreement with the journal's policy and the convictions of the editors, specifically in regard to the author's view of the Eastern question and the war of the last year. There you go. Self-published the eighth part, or at least published it elsewhere, because where it had been serialized, they didn't want it because of his opinions, which were blatantly interposed onto the characters of the book. Swim said the mama fishy said, finally, I've been waiting for the Slavonic question debate to begin so that I could share a fun fact. The prince says, for I see that there are others besides me who are only as interested in Russia and not their brother Slavs, and Constantine is one. Katvov's Russian Herald, which was serializing Tolstoy's enormously popular novel as it came out, declined to carry the eighth part, instead printing the following note. In the previous issue, the words "to be continued" appeared at the end of the Anna Karenina installment, but with the death of the heroine, the novel really comes to an end. The author had planned an epilogue of a few pages, in which we learn that Vronsky, distraught and grieving, left for Serbia as a volunteer in the army. The other characters are all well, but Levin, in his country retreat, remains hostile to the volunteers and the Slavophiles. Perhaps the author will add chapters to this effect in a special edition to this novel. The Herald slyly implies that Levin, the character in Anna Karenina most directly based on Tolstoy, is not quite well. While killing off Anna at the end of the penultimate issue may have been bad timing suspense-wise, the real problem was probably that the Herald was campaigning for the intervention of in the Balkans in the face of Tsar Alexander II's continued hesitation. Tolstoy brought out Part 8 of Anna Karenina in a separate edition at personal expense. I'll share the link tomorrow because it discusses the next chapter and I don't want to spoil. Appreciate it. I Am Norwegian said, I never thought I'd find myself siding with Sergei, or, well, I'm in between them. I don't respect the will of the people. The population of a country can have an average opinion on something which is wrong or unjustifiable. The right thing to do doesn't change based on their whims. But should you come across a situation like Sergei brings up, of a woman being beaten by drunks, then you intercede. Simply Productive says, I guess it does make you think about what justifies a war, though, doesn't it? In our modern society, we reject war in basically any situation, but then again, with the exception of certain countries, for the most part, we have legal requirements of equality and humane treatment of avoiding slavery, though it is the worst it has ever been. It is very heavily demonized, as it should be. Serious crimes are at an all-time low by a large amount, and by and large, we have been globally hoping to end all war. The war to end all wars is a slogan for a reason. But what about atrocities? What about genocide, torture, political imprisonment, lynchings, assassinations, and the like? My own answer came to me quickly. I'm a girl. And rightly or wrongly, my parents, with their strict gender roles, seem to have kicked in on this topic with me. It's not my place to decide whether war is right or wrong. It's just not in my nature because I'm a nurturer. I'm a bit shocked and appalled at myself for feeling this way, but there it is. I could never be a warrior or a member of the military. I know most people have emergency daydreams where they fixate on what to do in an emergency. And for me, the emergency is being robbed at gunpoint. And while my internal dialogue assures me that I can do a quadruple spinny kick and disarm the assailant, I never, and I mean never, imagined shooting or killing someone. Almost everyone has these daydreams, and it's quite normal for people to imagine killing in self-defense, but I don't. So I guess maybe I see both sides. On one hand, obviously we want to stop bad things from happening, but on the other, I'm not one to do it. So, do I have an opinion about the slabs? No. That's a long way to get to no. But thank you for the comment. I bet you could do a triple, quadruple, spinny kick and disarm an assailant. You just need to try it sometime. Oh, God. Okay, I gotta keep reading. Keep reading. You guys don't need to hear my half-cooked opinion today. I think I'll give you a night off from that. So here's chapter 16. Koznishev, an experienced dialectician, did not rejoin, but immediately turned the conversation into another region. Well, if you want to gauge the... Wait, I'm going to turn a light on. Oh, that's better. No straining my eyes. Well, if you want to gauge the national spirit... Arithmetically, of course, that is very difficult to do. Voting has not been introduced in our country and cannot be because it does not express the people's will. But there are other means. It is felt in the air. It is felt by the heart. Not to mention the undercurrents that have stirred in the motionless sea of the nation and which are evident to every unprejudiced person. Look at society in the narrower sense. The most divergent parties in the intellectual world, previously so hostile to one another, have all merged into one. All differences are at an end, and all the social organs say one and the same thing. All have felt an elemental force that has seized them and carries them all in one direction. Yes, all the papers say the same thing, said the prince. That's true. So much the same that they are just like frogs before a storm. They prevent our hearing anything else. Frogs or no frogs, I don't publish a newspaper and don't want to defend them, but I am speaking of the unanimity of the intelligent world, said Koznishev, turning to his brother. Levin was going to reply, but the old prince interrupted him. About that unanimity, something else can be said, rejoined the prince. There's my son-in-law, Stephen Arkadyevich. You know him. He has now got the post of member of the committee of a commission of something or other. I don't remember. Anyhow, there is nothing to do there. Well, Dolly, it's no secret, and the salary is 8,000. You just ask him if his work will be any use, and he will prove to you that it is most necessary. And he is a truthful man, but one can't help believing in the usefulness of 8,000 rubles. Yes, he asked me to tell Darya Alektrovna that he has got the post, said Koznishev discontentedly, considering that what the prince was saying was not to the point. So it is with the unanimity of the press, it has been explained to me. As soon as there is a war, their revenue is doubled. How can they help, considering that the fate of the people of, and the Slavs and all the rest of it? There are many papers I don't like, but that is unfair, said Koznishev. I would make it only one stipulation, continued the prince. Alphonse Karr put it very well. Before the war with Prussia. You think war is unavoidable? Very well. He who preaches war, off with him in a special legion to the assault, to the attack, in front of everybody else. The editors would be fine, remarked Katavasov, laughing loudly, and picturing to himself the editors of his acquaintance in that chosen legion. Oh, but they'd run away, said Dolly, and only be in a hindrance. And if they run, put grape shot behind them, or Cossacks with whips, said the prince. That is a joke, and excuse me, prince, not a good joke, said Koznishev. I don't see that it is a joke, that began Levin, but Koznishev interrupted him. Every member of society is called upon to do his proper task, he said, and men of thought perform theirs by expressing public opinion. The unanimous and complete expression of public opinion is a service rendered by the press, and is also a gratifying phenomenon. 20 years ago, we should have been silent, but now we hear the voice of the Russian people, who are ready to arise as one man and to sacrifice themselves for their oppressed brethren. That is a great step and a sign of power. But it's not a question of sacrificing themselves only, but of killing the Turks. But of killing Turks, remarked Levin timidly. The people sacrifice and are ready to sacrifice for the good of their souls, but not for murder, he added, involuntarily connecting the conversation with the thoughts that so engrossed him. What is that, for their souls? You have that expression. It's a puzzling one for a naturalist. What is a soul? Katavasov inquired with a smile. Oh, you know. No, I swear I have not the slightest idea, said Katavasov, laughing loudly. I come not to bring peace but a sword, said Christ, rejoined Koznishev, from his own standpoint, quoting quite simply, as if it were quite comprehensible, the very passage from the Gospels that always perplexed Levin more than any other. That's just so, repeated the old man, who was standing nearby, answering a glance that was accidentally thrown at him. No, my dear sir, you are beaten, completely beaten, shouted Katavasov merrily. Levin flushed with annoyance, not at being beaten, but because he had not refrained from the dispute. No, I must not dispute with them, he thought. They are clad in impenetrable armour, and I am naked. He saw that it was not possible to convince his brother and Katavasov, and still less did he see any possibility of himself agreeing with them. What they advocated was that same pride of intellect that had nearly ruined him. He could not agree that some dozen of men, among whom was his brother, had the right to assert, on the strength of what they were told by some hundreds of grandiloquent volunteers who came to the city, that they and the newspapers expressed the will and the opinion of the people, an opinion, moreover, which found expression in vengeance and murder. He could not agree with this, because he neither saw the expression of those thoughts in the people among whom he lived, nor did he find any such thoughts in himself. And he could not consider himself as other than one of those who constituted the Russian people. Above all, he could not agree because he, together with the people, did not know and could not know wherein lay the general welfare, but knew definitely that the attainment of this welfare was only possible by a strict fulfilment of the law of goodness which is revealed to every man, and therefore could not desire or preach war for any kind of general aims. He said the same as Mikhailich and the people who expressed their thoughts, in the legend of the invitation to the Varyags. The footnote says, the Norse chiefs who, at the dawn of Russian history, were invited by the Slav tribes of Russia to come and rule over them and establish order. Come and rule over us. We joyfully promise complete obedience. All labours, all humiliations, all sacrifices we take upon ourselves, but we will not judge or decide. But the people now, according to his brother, were renouncing that exemption they had purchased at so high a price. He wanted to ask why. If public opinion is an infallible judge, is a revolution and a commune not unlawful as the movement in favour of the Slavs? But all these were thoughts that could not decide anything. One thing could be seen indubitably, namely that this dispute was irritating his brother at the moment, and that therefore it was wrong to continue it. So, Levin ceased to argue and drew his visitors' attention to the clouds that were gathering and to the fact that they had better get home before the rain began. All right, another chapter down. Thank you very much for listening. See you tomorrow.